40. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert. A bad couple of days in Las Vegas late last year could have derailed Illinois' basketball season. Back-to-back losses to Utah and Bradley at a tournament in November cost the Illini their top 25 ranking and led to humbling losses to Georgia and Gonzaga. But Illinois could be closing in on an NCAA bid in spite of it all, thanks to the rapid improvement of point guard Dimitri McKamey and freshman DJ Richardson. Illinois has beaten its share of ranked teams this season. The Illini are 18-10 and face Minnesota at home tomorrow before closing with two ranked teams, Ohio State and Wisconsin. Coach Bruce Weber says McKamey's leadership, scoring, and assists are the big reasons this team is still in the NCAA mix. Purdue coach Matt Painter knows that some believe his third-ranked Boilermakers are in trouble after losing forward Robbie Hummel for the season with a torn ACL in his right knee. Painter disagrees, saying today that he feels good about the players he has, including center Jawan Johnson and guard Etwan Moore, who is averaging 17 points a game. At 24-3 and 12-3 in the Big Ten, the Boilermakers are on a 10-game winning streak, enjoying their highest national ranking since 1994. December leaves Wisconsin Athletic Director Barry Alvarez empty because the conference lacks a football title game. The Big Ten is considering expanding. The process could end with the championship Alvarez wants, but not all conference presidents and ADs are enthusiastic. And there may be as many reasons to stick to the status quo as there are to grow. One is money. The conference gives its schools more than any other. Expansion would mean smaller shares if new schools aren't big money makers. Academics are another. Only a few schools have been mentioned as good matches. They include Rutgers, Syracuse, and Texas. Ultimately, U of I interim president Stanley Eikenberry thinks the Big Ten will decide against expanding. That's a look at sports.
I'm Diane Adams. My friends call me Dee Dee. I was born blind. My husband worked with visually impaired older folks. He would talk about the radio reader. He'd say, I ordered this radio reader for so-and-so, and so one day I said, I would really love to have one of those.
At the Illinois Radio Reader, local newspapers, books, and magazines and periodicals are read and recorded by over 70 volunteers, and then those programs are broadcast to those visually impaired people who have our radios in their homes.
It is literally our newspaper. I feel we as visually impaired people are so privileged to have a service like this. I'm Dee Dee Adams from Decatur, and WILL is my source for the Illinois Radio Reader.
An airport bottleneck is about to get tighter. One of the busiest runways in the country will shut down for 4 months of repair starting next week. It's at the John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, which handles more than 40 million passengers every year. From member station WNYC, Lisa Chow reports on what air traffic controllers and airlines have done to prepare.
As snow falls in the northeast this morning, delays and cancellations at Kennedy Airport are up from the norm. And the norm isn't so good. One in every five flights at Kennedy left late last year. And we're not talking 20 minutes late. The average delay was more than an hour. We go up in the air traffic control tower at Kennedy, 17 floors above ground level. There, Stephen Abraham talks to pilots who are ready to land.
Primary 588 Kennedy Tower following heavy Boeing 767 inside Zulab, caution wake turbulence with 340 and 10.
Abraham has been working as an air traffic controller here for 20 years. He points to a monitor which shows the airspace above the airport. Arriving planes are represented in green dots on the screen.
You want them 5. You don't want them 4.9 because that's illegal, and you don't want them 5.5 because you're wasting space.
Translation: Abraham has to make sure that planes landing at the airport are 5 miles apart from each other. Less than that, and he's got a safety issue on his hands. More than that, and he's got an efficiency problem. That's because wasted airspace means wasted time, which means wasted money for everyone. That's just one balancing act air traffic controllers have to deal with. Throw in snow, wind direction, and starting next week, the closure of a runway that handles half of all departures from Kennedy. Their job is about to get a lot harder.
You clear somebody for takeoff, you watch. You cross airplanes across the runway that you've just used, and you look in specific places. They're called hot spots in the airport.
Abraham and other air traffic controllers have been doing simulated and live test runs this month.
That's all new now. We have brand new hot spots and places that you wouldn't normally have to train your eyes to look.
Nothing like this has been done at this scale, at least, in the system before.
Bill Craner is director of air traffic systems for JetBlue, the largest carrier at Kennedy. He says worst-case scenario, all planes arriving and departing could be forced onto a single runway because of strong northwest winds. Craner and Abraham both work on the front lines and believe the runway closure will exacerbate delays. Their supervisors are more optimistic. Dave Barger is the CEO of JetBlue.
Sure, we're going to know that it's happening over the course of 120 days. You have to when you take 14,572 feet of pavement out of service, right, for literally a third of the year. But I think there's real good preparation going into place to make sure that we mitigate the impact of that.
To head off those delays, the three major airlines at Kennedy, JetBlue, Delta, and American, are cutting their flight schedules by 10 to 15%. Now, with so many flights going in and out of Newark, there's another factor to consider. Every plane makes about 5 to 6 trips a day, which means a flight delayed in New York might not get to Chicago in time to take its next set of passengers to Los Angeles. The Federal Aviation Administration has not analyzed how this runway closure could affect delays in other parts of the country. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Chow in New York.
For 9 years now, a private developer has been working to get approval for 130 wind turbines on Cape Cod. Local opposition has been strong. Now, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is poised to decide whether the country's first offshore wind farm can be built there. Sean Corcoran reports from member station WCAI.
The waters of Nantucket Sound were unseasonably calm when the Interior Secretary stood near the bow of the Coast Guard vessel Ida Lewis recently on his first visit to the proposed wind farm site. Here, the wind typically blows at an average speed of 19 miles per hour, making it popular with recreational sailors. But during Salazar's visit, not even a brief gust threatened his trademark Black Stetson, as he announced that after nearly a decade of review, it was time to decide the fate of the project called Cape Wind.
And I think the worst thing that we can do for the country is to be in a state of indecision, and this application has been in a state of indecision for a very long time.
Cape Cod is that arm-shaped peninsula that extends out from Massachusetts, and Cape Wind's closest 440-foot tall turbine would be 5 miles to its south in Nantucket Sound. It's shallow here, less than a foot deep in some places, which is one of the reasons Cape Wind officials insist it's the region's best location for an offshore wind farm. Whether that's true or not is now up to Salazar, and no matter what he decides about this project, Salazar says offshore wind power is coming to the United States.
But as I've always said, with respect to renewable energy on the onshore, it's important to do wind energy in the right places. That is the critical question that we're addressing here at Nantucket Sound. You know, is this the right place for wind energy or is it not?
For the past year, Cape Wind has been on a winning streak with court victories, state approvals, and a mostly favorable environmental impact statement from the federal government. Mark Rogers, the communications director for Cape Wind, says that since it first was announced in 2001, the billion-dollar project has garnered strong statewide support with its promise to meet two-thirds of the Cape's electricity needs while offering energy independence and fewer greenhouse gas emissions.
Cape Wind has wider and deeper support than any energy project in the history of New England. Leading environmental organizations, labor unions, trade associations, and just across the general public.
But most local officials here oppose its location in an area used by fishermen and boaters, and the local Chamber of Commerce says Cape Wind is a threat to the region's only industry, tourism. Until his death last year, the most prominent opponent was Senator Ted Kennedy, whose family life on Nantucket Sound was well documented. Now, the loudest voice against the project comes from two local Native American tribes.
We're the Wampanoag, people of the First Light, and it's our responsibility to greet that day.
That's Bettina Washington, the historic preservation officer for the Wampanoag tribe of Gayhead on Martha's Vineyard. She says the project would infringe on the tribe's religious and cultural rights by interfering with their view of the rising sun, and it also may disturb archaeological evidence of tribal life.
The waters now cover what we know were ancestral homelands that we walked. We lived there. We went to the edge of those shores to fish, and we interred our dead in those lands that are now covered by water.
The strong Native American opposition may present the final hurdle for the project. Last fall, the Wampanoag successfully petitioned to have Nantucket Sound declared eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places, making the permitting process more difficult. Salazar met with the tribes for a sunrise ceremony during his visit to the Cape. He says he's taking their concerns seriously as he wades through all the issues, with an eye towards releasing his decision sometime in April. For NPR News, I'm Sean Corcoran on Cape Cod.
Every once in a while, we hear politicians using a term that everybody thinks they understand, but people define differently. Lester Graham talked with an expert about one such term heard a lot these days.
I got to thinking about that when I heard Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma call for sound science at a recent subcommittee hearing. And then moments later, Senator David Vitter repeated that call for sound science.
I think the answer is exactly what Senator Inhofe and others have been saying. Sound science, complete focus on, complete reliance on sound science above all else.
So sound science, I think most of us think that means well-researched, unbiased, verifiable science. Joining us now is Oliver Hauck. He's a professor of law at Tulane University. So, Professor, what's that term, sound science, mean to members of Congress?
It means whatever they want it to mean. The first thing you have to understand is sound science is not a scientific term at all. It has no scientific definition. It's like saying sound congressman or sound senator. It's in the eye of the beholder. In the legal world, everyone knows what sound science is. It's the science that supports your client's position, and bad science is the science that is on the other side. So in the real world, it's a very cynical term, and it's very cynically used. That isn't to say there isn't junk science, but in the political world, this is a political term. Frank Lutz, the Republican strategist in the early 2000s, sent a very well-known memorandum out to all Republican congressmen and senators saying that the coming issue was climate change and the world consensus that this was urgent and something had to be done was overwhelming and irresistible. The only loophole, the only point of attack would be to attack the science. And so they did, with great success.
Has this term sound science always been attached to this political baggage?
Yes, it has, but it's come in different forms, and it's not always been purely environmental. The term was actually invented by Philip Morris and the Tobacco Institute back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s when the tobacco wars were going on and the industry was denying any addictive effects and any carcinogenic effects. And so Philip Morris had the audacity in 1992 to set up something called the Advancement of Sound Science Committee. And that was, of course, its lobby to pick apart scientists whose findings were otherwise, while, of course, Philip Morris buried all findings of these same effects, a burying that ultimately led to civil suits and brought it down, but only a peg. This has always been the blast back. If you can stop this thing at the beach by discrediting the science, you don't have to deal with any regulatory or any other requirements. So
calling for sound science is a delay tactic.
Oh, clearly so. Clearly so. And they know it. And they know it.
Oliver Hauck is the professor of environmental law at Tulane University in New Orleans and author of the book Taking Back Eden, 8 Environmental Cases That Changed the World. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Oliver Hauck talking with the Environment Report's Lester Graham. People can now carry guns in national parks. The National Park Service is adapting to the new law. Samara Freemark has that story.
The new policy means a reversal for the nation's 392 national park sites. Firearms have been prohibited in the parks, but now...
whatever law you were under in that state outside of the park now applies within the national park unit.
That's National Park Service spokesman David Barna. He says that means that parks everywhere except Illinois and Washington, D.C. will allow firearms. But different states have different laws about the specifics, for example, whether you can conceal your weapon or not. Barna says that could get complicated.
Appalachian Trail passes over 14 states. Yellowstone National Park is in 3 states. And the burden is going to be on the public to know those various laws.
Barna says the Park Service will help gun owners out with website updates and postings, but he says they can't put up notices every time a park trail crosses a state line. For the Environment Report, I'm Samara Freemark.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Technoscience Initiative presents Mix and Scratch, The Turntable Becomes a Musical Instrument, 1975 to 1978, by Mark Katz at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, March 9th at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum, online at www.cas.illinois.edu.
People who commit sex crimes will likely get put on a government list of sex offenders. What about an offender registry for people who are cruel to animals?
We're talking about things like violence, torture, mutilation, intentional killing of animals.
California considers boosting its animal protection laws with an animal cruelty registry. That story later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Earth and Sky.
Drew Schindel is a climate scientist with the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. At a science meeting in late 2009, he told EarthSky about his approach to studying the way various emissions interact in Earth's atmosphere.
In the more abstract physical science world, you look at what's the overall effect of methane or carbon dioxide or ozone or one thing at a time. In fact, if you were to try to reduce emissions, they would be by particular activities, like burning coal to generate electricity or driving vehicles.
Schindel said that burning coal, for example, doesn't just emit carbon dioxide gas. There are also other particles and gases that escape into the air.
These other things that both lead to warming that are non-CO2 agents also contribute to air pollution. So it gives us an opportunity to deal with two large-scale environmental problems at once.
Schindel said a good policy would target a greenhouse gas emitting activity and regulate it in order to improve air quality and slow climate change.
A joint strategy to deal with both air quality and climate change at the same time can provide better solutions to both problems than what we've been pursuing to date, which is really looking at each one independently.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Mike Solis, forecast for Illinois and Indiana. The remainder of the afternoon, we're looking at mostly sunny skies in Illinois and southwest Indiana. Northern and eastern Indiana, mostly cloudy skies, scattered snow showers and flurries. Highs ranging from 28 in northern Illinois to 44 in the far south. Tonight in western and southern Illinois and in far southwestern Indiana, mostly clear skies. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers and flurries, lows ranging from 12 in northwestern Illinois to 25 in eastern Indiana. Tomorrow in west central and southern Illinois and far southwestern Indiana, mostly sunny skies. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers and flurries, highs ranging from 30 in northwestern Illinois to 45 in the far south. The forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny, breezy the remainder of the day, a high of 35. We're down to 34 now. The wind up to 10 to 20 miles an hour from the northwest. Increasing clouds tonight, the low 18. Winds from the northwest, 8 to 16 miles an hour. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with some flurries. The high 35, winds from the northwest, 8 to 16. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night with a chance of flurries, the low 21. Mostly cloudy on Sunday with a high of 38. Mostly cloudy skies Sunday night, the low 23. Mostly cloudy Monday with a high of 38. Again, 34 degrees on Friends Plaza in Urbana.